Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Last week, on Thursday, Valentine's Day, Stephen Kazmierczyk stepped out onto the stage of a lecture hall on the campus of Northern Illinois University in DeKalb and started shooting. By the time that this was all over, he had killed five students and he had shot himself. Whenever these events occur, and since 1996, there have been more than 100 people killed in major shootings at schools and universities around the world. Whenever one of these events occurs, the question that we're ultimately left with is why? What was it that motivated these individuals to commit these crimes? Can we understand them? And in the process of understanding them, can we do what can be done to prevent such a thing from happening again? In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to explore some of these questions with Dave Cullen. He is a journalist who has, perhaps more than anyone else, spent time trying to think about and understand the shootings that took place at Columbine in Colorado back in March of 2009. In fact, he is the author of a book that will be coming out the shootings took place in 1999. His book is scheduled to come out in March of 2009, and the title is A Lasting Impression on the World, The Definitive Account of Columbine and Its Aftermath. He has contributed to a number of periodicals, including Slate, Salon, The New York Times. He is a graduate of the University of Illinois. He grew up in Chicago, has worked in most regions of the country, as well as England, Kuwait, and Bahrain. He now makes his home in Denver, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, we certainly welcome questions and comments from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep our own program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly questions from people who are listening are welcome. The number, if you are listening here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or over the internet in the United States, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can give us a call. Again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Cullen, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, despite the subject matter.
Well, hopefully it will give us an opportunity to at least explore some of these questions. And I think that it is true, certainly true, that whenever this kind of thing happens, in addition to the feelings of loss and sadness that people have, what they are left with is that big question. They want to know, why? Why did this person do this? And in this particular case, the case of Northern Illinois University and those shootings, some further details about the shooter have come out. Perhaps we will learn more. It's difficult because, and I think that you've spent some time looking at what is known about this young man, and that there's so far frustratingly little. At least there's not much that can help us to understand him. Maybe that will change. You've spent quite a bit of time looking at the Columbine shootings, and I know that you also spent some time looking at the shootings and the person involved in Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. Let me just, as an overall question, and then we can get into some specifics. I think that there are some people, eventually they get to the point where they kind of throw up their hands and say, events like this ultimately cannot be explained, and these people cannot be understood, and you just have to say, well, there are some things in life that can't be explained and can't be understood. Do you think that that's the case?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. I think what is the case, there's something very similar that I think gets people bogged down. If you look at all the cases together and try to understand, quote, the school shooter, or however you want to define them, then you're going to run into trouble. There is no overall reason or profile. And there was a great study done by the Secret Service and the Department of Education was the definitive study that studied all the school shooters for about a 20-year period and found that and emphasized several times in bold in the report, there is no single profile for the school shooter. So if you try to look across all of them, you're really going to come into trouble because people do it for different reasons. But there are groups of reasons that most of the people fall into. And then when you get to specific cases, in every case there is a reason. And usually we can get to the bottom of it. I mean, sometimes, and this could be one of those times, that hopefully not, we can't really ever quite put it all together. But usually there does a pretty clear reason in the killer's mind does turn out to exist. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, you know, once you group them into different types of kinds of killings, you see that there really aren't that many different varieties either. So it really does come into focus, so you can sort of understand what's going on. If you try to avoid falling into the trap of, you know, all of them being the same.
Well, let's talk a bit about Columbine, because this is something, as I said, you've spent a lot of time working on this particular story and trying to get a better understanding of that. And I think that, again, if people look back to this and think back to the discussion surrounding this and the attempts to explain why it is that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold killed these teachers and their classmates at Columbine, the thing that we'll come back to is this picture of them, this idea that they were social outcasts, that they had been the victim of a lot of bullying, and that it finally got to be too much for them, and what this was retribution for the kind of suffering that had been inflicted on, social suffering that had been inflicted on them as a result. You think that that's not, in fact, the reason that they did what they did?
Correct. At the beginning, I assumed that was the reason too, like everybody else. But really, when you read their journals, and the police finally released just about a year and a half ago, released almost 1,000 pages of writing between the two of them. So you got school assignments, you got their journals, the videotapes they made, and all sorts of stuff from them. And Dylan's journal is almost 100 pages. And spent 2 years. And Eric's is over the course of 1 year. They did not mention bullying one time. They do not complain about being picked on ever. They have a laundry list of everything imaginable that they complain about. We would blow your mind all the kinds of things that they complain about in the world. And bullying is not even on the list. And they complain about the same kinds of things over and over again. And it never comes up. And in fact, so unless they were completely trying to distort and, you know, convince us that they weren't victims of bullying, it's just not there. Some of their friends have said, and the friends sort of conflict a bit on this, but some of their friends say that they were picked on, especially more so Eric, who was much shorter. Dylan was over 6 foot tall. I think he was 6'4" or something already in high school. And, it wasn't the kind of people that people picked on. But they both got in trouble for picking on younger kids several times. They got suspended, actually. Dylan got called to the dean for scratching something obscene into a freshman's locker. And there was an incident there was a really interesting exchange where in German class, Eric exchanged notes with a girl, a friend of his, and those survived. She kept it, the little paper that they sent back and forth. And Eric was talking about this guy he'd gotten in a fight with earlier, and the guy was really afraid of Eric now. And she was talking about how afraid the kid was for her, and the girl was trying to sort of act on the other guy's behalf and tried to settle it. And Eric said, well, maybe I will, quit being mad at him or whatever, or stand down if he lets me punch him in the face. Hmm. And the girl's like, really? And he's like, yeah, he has to stand down and let me just punch him in the face, and then I'll let it go. I mean, so this is the kind of brutal person and who had some kid quaking his boots. Eric was more the bullier than the bullied. Hmm. that was something that the media came up with, and they found the trench coat mafia and thought that had something to do with it, and kids in the trench coat mafia had been bullied. Eric and Dylan were just sort of maybe fringe members at best. So the media took this whole thing about the trench coat mafia and applied it to them, which really wasn't so. The press also has this conception of school shooters as bullied and as outcasts and loners. And that's not really true either. It is true. I'm looking at the Secret Service report right now. quite a few of the school shooters have felt bullied, persecuted, or injured. Actually, 71% reported some form of that. So the Columbine killers were actually the exception there. They reported either being teased or bullied or so forth, although probably a lot of kids in high school would say that. But as far as being loners or outcasts, that is usually not the case. I'm looking here. Most of the kids, not loners. Okay, here, I just tabbed the pages. 41% of the kids were defined as mainstream. 34% were described as loners. So you get a fair amount of loners, but not the majority.
Well, if that conventional explanation, the loner, social outcast, victim of bullying explanation, just doesn't hold, particularly if you actually take the time to investigate the atmosphere and talk with as many people as you possibly can to get a more full picture. So if that doesn't work, then what are you left with as an explanation? And do we find out that what we're actually dealing with is people who may have emotional problems, may indeed be experiencing or suffering from some kind of mental illness, at the very least have really serious anger issues that are not dealt with and smolder to the point where they actually explode? I mean, how do you explain it then?
Well, the three most common sort of groupings, if you want to call it that, of explanations, we saw the big three that are the most common. We saw all three of them between Columbine and Virginia Tech. So I'll just run through those three if that's
sure.
Makes sense. Sure. So the big three are a depressive, generally an angry depressive. Number two would be a psychopath, which is not sort of the Hollywood definition of a psychopath, but I'll tell you a little more about that in a sec. And then the third would be somebody who really is mentally ill. And then we'd be talking about Joe in Virginia Tech, who appeared to be extremely mentally ill, probably schizophrenic. And here we're talking about somebody who really is what most people would refer to as crazy, where potentially, voices in his head speaking to him, really out of touch with reality and literally not knowing what he was doing, in a sense. I mean, knowing that he's taking a gun and killing people, but not necessarily being in the same world with the rest of us and getting the consequences of that. I mean, really off his rocker. So mentally insane, and if he had lived, probably would have been ruled that way and spent the rest of his life in a mental institution. So that's what we're talking about with Joe. Now, that is somewhat less common. There's usually not true mental insanity going on, where he sort of doesn't know what's going on. The other two cases are psychopath and depressive, and I'll just tell you really quickly with. Those were the two cases in Columbine, where Eric Harris was clearly a psychopath and Dylan was a classic depressive. And in Harris' case, a psychopath is someone who Ted Bundy is a really good example of him. A lot of serial killers are psychopaths. And usually psychopaths are nonviolent, but when they are violent, when they are murderers, they tend to be serial killers, where they actually enjoy killing and enjoy inflicting pain. But overall, a psychopath is someone who, essentially, they lack empathy and they lack a conscience. And so everything is about them. They have incredibly high egos, and everything is about their own ego gratification and their own needs. And most often, they're swindlers, con men, white-collar criminals. It's about getting money, getting, girls. They do tend to be male. Getting rich, getting happy, getting all their needs met at the expense of everyone else around them. They're extreme users. When they also have a sadistic side coupled with the psychopathy where they just don't care what happens to the rest of you, then they tend to be serial killers. And, I don't know if I explained that well. But it's someone when – if you consider somebody who doesn't really experience emotions like the rest of us and doesn't have feelings, it doesn't matter to them what happens to you. So for Eric Harris, killing those people was sort of the equivalent of a little boy who sees an anthill and sees all the ants scurrying around and decides to just stomp on all of them and just, you know, destroy them. It means nothing to him. You know, killing people means nothing to Eric Harris. He doesn't, if it's not happening, if pain is not happening to him, then he doesn't get it. And we can come back to those if you like, but it's probably not that relevant in this case. I don't see any signs that Kazmierczak, is that his name?
Yes, Kazmierczak.
Kazmierczak, yeah. I have trouble with that. I don't see any signs of psychopathy. But the third sort of big cluster of people, which may be the case here, may or may not, it was really typified by Dylan Klebold, who was depressive and extremely depressive. And when you have a depressive person, the route from depression to murder seems a little odd to most people at first, but it's not that hard to understand when you see the steps. So you picture somebody who's depressed. They're withdrawing from the world. They're angry at themselves. And psychologists often define depression as anger turned inward. So you've got this extreme anger because things are not going the way you want to, and so you're angry at yourself, and you're turning that inside. When someone is extremely depressed, typically the final step of depression, the worst over the scale, then will be suicide. Now, most people who go that route just end it all. They might leave a note. They want to kill themselves. They want to show the world, you know, you mistreated me. Look what you did to me. It was sort of all your fault, and they'll leave a note by that, like that. One step up from those people are the ones who they try to inflict some pain on the way out, not by hurting anybody physically, but psychologically. And the classic case is the guy who kills himself who's really mad at his wife, who will blow his brains out right in front of the wedding photo so his blood is splattered all over it, or pick some other symbol to desecrate, to show her, look what you did to me. This is not a coincidence that I did it right here. And gives her the message that, you know, if you had been a better wife, if you had treated me right and made me happy, I would be alive now. It's your fault. So that's sort of the next stage up of someone lashing out. You go from there, and that, you know, that's a very tiny percentage. That's less than 1% of suicide, of depressive suicides, sort of seek that kind of vengeance from the grave. A smaller percentage than that want to go still further. They want to kill themselves. Getting rid of themselves is sort of the main goal, but they also want to make some other people pay on the way out. So those people, typically the next rung up, are people who will inflict the damage on what they consider to be the guilty party. So typically it's either the boss, the girlfriend, or the friends, or the, you know, the sort of the other social people who ignored him, didn't let him in, or what have you. You know, whoever he sees is causing the trouble, he will kill typically one, sometimes two of those people on the way out. But it's very specific. It's going after the people who inflicted the pain. The next group up from that, and here, you know, we keep going to smaller and smaller percentages, fractions of fractions. The next most vindictive group will kill themselves, but kill if the girlfriend, if it was, you know, a love thing, and then also perhaps her friend who he knew had, you know, bad-mouthed him and helped undermine the relationship. Or if it were a boss he were taking out, he might take out the boss and the person who, you know, caused him not to get the promotion because some other coworker who, you know, undermined him with the boss. He'll take that person as well. So now we're branching out a little bit further into the world. Then you get the smaller fraction still who wants to take out the people close to him and other guilty parties and says, you know, it's the whole system that did this to me. You know, the odds are always stacked against me. I was never going to be able to succeed because, you know, the whole system is screwed up. And then those people either take out additional people or sometimes then you get the random person who is just, it isn't just my girlfriend, it isn't just my boss, it's everyone, they're all doing this to me, they all need to pay. And then you've got somebody who will just go out randomly and cause an event to inflict pain to the general public, and, you know, you've got the people who especially then know it's going to be on TV, be on the news, and it will terrify the whole world. And now you're getting into a situation like this, like Dylan Klebold, or perhaps a person at NIU who was so angry at himself and wanted to kill himself and went in there planning to kill himself, but wanted to really show the world and take out his anger on all the rest of us, and knew by doing this it would be on TV, it would terrorize the public. You know, kids would be afraid to go to school, parents would be afraid to send their kids off to college, and so forth. So that's sort of the third kind that builds up to this angry, depressive.
We have some callers here. I want to bring them into the conversation.
Okay.
And for anybody who's listening here, I want to introduce again our guest, Dave Cullen. He's a journalist and author. He's contributed to many periodicals, including Slate, Salon, and The New York Times. Has spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about the shootings that took place at Columbine. This was back in 1999. He has authored a book that's scheduled for publication in a year, next March, 2009. The title of the book, A Lasting Impression on the World, The Definitive Account of Columbine and Its Aftermath. He also, by the way, has a website if you're interested in reading more about him and his work, DaveCullen.com. He makes his home in Denver, and he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have several people here ready to go. We'll start, take him in order, and start with Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Hello. Both Cho and Kazmierczak had psychiatric problem histories, yet neither one of these histories showed up in any background check, which remains a glaring error of the process of getting a gun. But my question is, in regards to this Dylan Klebold, I'm wondering if possibly his dad named him Dylan after Marshall Dylan of Gunsmoke, James R. Ness, and if he inculcated this kind of Wild West shoot 'em up philosophy in his home life. Do you have any ideas? This may be a stretch.
I do. He actually was named after Dylan Thomas, the Irish poet.
Uh-huh.
His parents met at University of Michigan, and they were both intellectuals, and I believe they were in grad school at the time, and they were both studying art initially, and they were great fans of the poet Dylan Thomas, who wrote, he's most famous for Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, and so they named him after that. Now, they were really sort of gentle spirits, And they wouldn't allow guns or anything like that in the house. They were sort of the other end of the spectrum. So you know, he didn't get it there. I think he got it from Eric. I mean, Eric was really the mastermind of Columbine, and Dylan was really, really depressed. He spoke about about suicide 2 years earlier when the day he started his journal. He talked about committing suicide. And there's actually a point in his journal more than a year before, I think a little more than a year before Columbine, where he actually says goodbye. And he plans to kill himself before Columbine. And then he comes back about 6 months later. There's the one huge gap in his journal. And he says, well, I'm back, and I didn't expect to still be alive, and blah, blah, blah. And sort of lamenting the fact that he hasn't been able to bring himself to commit suicide. But while he was already discussing Columbine with Eric, and they already had the date, they had the month of April 99 down and the location in the Commons, long after that, Dylan was still planning to commit suicide, and apparently was not telling Eric that he didn't plan to go along with it. He planned to kill himself before it ever happened. But Eric had a completely different... Eric was fascinated with guns and with fire and explosions from a very early age, which isn't necessarily that unusual. He loved firecrackers from a very early age and wrote in one of his school essays about one of his first early memories. Actually, it was his very first memory. It was 4th of July and the explosions going off. And at first it scared him, and then it thrilled him. And his dad was an Air Force major, and he dreamed of being a Marine, and he would play gun battles with his brother and a friend, and he was an Army brat, who went from base to base around the country, and they were always fantasizing about war games, and, you know, they had their little fake guns, and they played, so he had a lot of that going on, Eric did, but not, you know, in a typical sort of boys will be boys kind of way where you wouldn't expect him to be killing people.
Eric moved around a lot, then, you say, so that would be very disruptive to his social life and foster alienation.
Yes, he complained about that. You know, he said that he was always getting moved around, and he called himself the runt of the litter, that he was always sort of at the bottom of the food chain. That's also typical of psychopaths. Psychopaths are always complaining that everything is stacked against them, and they will take any situation and make themselves the martyr out of it. I think we have to. There are sort of two things. One thing is it can be difficult on a child, and it probably was difficult for him moving around. But I think then he might have also exaggerated just how horrible it was. But he was also a fairly popular kid in the different places. He had lots of different groups of friends. He was somewhat shy, but he got on well. He was considered well loved. He played in Little League and other sports things in the different cities, and he seemed to do pretty well for himself. But his take on it was that it was awful.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. We're already past our midpoint, and I have some other callers, and I would like to bring in some other folks here. Going next to someone in Champaign, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. I want to start by saying I have some experience in this. I worked as a forensic clinician for a period of time with people who were judged not guilty by reason of insanity for various things such as murder, attempted murder, rape, and so on and so forth. I had thought about this when I heard that Kaczmierczyk had stopped taking his medication. Of course, I don't know anything further about his diagnosis and the medication. There's some reports, but they're not very clear. But I think it's hard. I mean, I heard your classification, and it sounds good, but I my own experience is that the variations among people in terms of their, I'll use the word psychosis, their delusional beliefs, their paranoia, varies extremely. Some of it might make sense to us. Some of it doesn't even make sense to them when they're doing it or afterwards. Often it's connected to stopping taking medication, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes they continue to take the medication, but just some factors, whether internal or external, have exacerbated their conditions and what makes them do what they're doing. So, having said that, I want to go on to talk about what I see as the two major issues here. One has to do with medication and what one can do when someone stops taking medication, and the fact that right now, unless one has a court order, you can't force someone to take medication. I mean, I worked with people where because I was working with the courts, I was able to force them. Even in that case, I had problems, because unless you monitor their taking the medication or unless it's injected, you have no certainty. And as I said, even then, internal conditions can exacerbate their psychotic delusions, etc. The other side of it is the issues about they're able to have weapons and the rules we do or don't place on who can buy weapons. And issues of civil liberties, issues, other issues tie in with all of this. So that's really what I see the issues with, let's say, this most recent NIU killing. Those are the issues that we really have to struggle with, because we've got two basic sets of conflicts, and I don't think we as a society are willing at this point to really examine that and make some hard choices. Which direction do we go, in terms of the public safety or in terms of individual freedoms? I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
I'm not sure I can, you know, fully answered that. But I would like to sort of help, hopefully, with the listeners, help clarify one thing that you and I both talked about, with to sort of break people into a couple categories. Just so if people understand the terminology, psychosis or psychotic is sort of a broad term for different groups of mental illnesses, like schizophrenia. And so forth, where you have a real, where you have delusions, where you have a real break with reality, where the person doesn't know what's going on. And like you said, he doesn't often understand what's going on in his own head. And that's a person who seems to be like Joe in Virginia Tech, a situation like that. And in a case like that, the person going off their meds, that's pretty serious. I mean, that's really serious. And, you know, I don't know. I'm, you know, tend to be a civil libertarian. I mean, I don't know how you keep them on it. I think the psychologists that I have talked to since Virginia Tech feel that we probably do need to go back to reinstitutionalizing some number of people, and that the trend, I guess it was during the Reagan administration about 30 years ago, when we deinstitutionalized so many people, probably went a little overboard, and that some people really can't function out on the streets by themselves. They need to be under supervision. And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, everybody who has a problem gets institutionalized, but I think there might be a certain number of people who really, you know, need to be in an institution, probably for their whole life. The other kind of people that we're talking about, though, then if I could take a whole different category of people who have depression and other things which are really serious illnesses and you know, are very important, but those people, I don't think that we can force them to take their meds. I think to them it's more of a choice because they are living in the real world. They're not delusional. They know what's going on, and they sort of have the ability to make their own choices. I think we would leave it in their hands. And I wanted to clarify a point, too. I didn't mean to jump too firmly and to suggest that Kazmierczak was necessarily a depressive. My thinking is that he's really kind of a mystery. And in this case, we don't know what was going on with him. And there are really, strangely, few signs of what was going on. But, you know, a few pieces of evidence that point in the potential direction of depression are obviously being on Prozac. If he's on antidepressives, obviously that you know, sends off an alarm that suggests that explanation of being a severe depressive is probably more likely than a lot of the other scenarios. And, you know, I don't think we could go any further than that at this point, except to say that, you know, there aren't significant signs of anything else. So, you know, if I were a detective, I would be looking more in that direction than others, but definitely not at the point where I would be concluding it.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. He raises very good questions. I only have about 15 minutes left. I have some other callers I want to include. Perhaps we can discuss more on this today or on another show. I do also want to mention another program that we have scheduled for Monday at 11 o'clock to try to talk about some of the concerns and questions people have raised about psychiatric medications and what they can do and what they can't, about potential side effects, about why people stop taking them, about the potential problems when people stop taking them. And our guest on Monday at 11 will be Dr. Gerald Kay. He is professor and chair of psychiatry at Wright State University School of Medicine. That's in Dayton, Ohio. So maybe some more on that particular piece. And also, I want again to mention that this morning's guest is Dave Cullen. He's journalist and author. His writing has appeared in Slate, in Salon, in the New York Times. He has spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about the Columbine shootings that took place in 1999 and has authored a book that's scheduled for publication in a year. So this will be March of 2009. The title, A Lasting Impression on the World, The Definitive Account of Columbine and Its Aftermath. And we're trying to talk some about that shooting, others like it, and also the one that took place on the campus of Northern Illinois University in DeKalb last week. Questions are certainly welcome, and we'll get in as many people as we can. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have other callers, and our next will be on line 3, and this is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm wondering to what extent, if at all, the caller has any formal training in psychology. That's question one. Question two, why has bipolar disorder not been mentioned, with the emphasis on problems in the depressive area related only to depression and not manic behavior? And finally, third, to what extent would credible psychiatrists agree with the differentiations that you've made?
Okay, thanks. First of all, no, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a journalist, a writer, and actually my degree from Illinois was math and computer science, and I did that for a while and moved on and got a master's in creative writing in English out here in Colorado. But the place that I've gotten from this, I've spent a good deal of the last 10 years working with psychologists and psychiatrists, some of the best ones in the world, with basically the team that the FBI brought in to Columbine. And it wasn't just Columbine. They actually convened a summit a few months after Columbine in July of 99 that was chaired by Janet Reno, then Attorney General, on the school shooters. And they brought in people involved, both law enforcement, victims, people close to the killers from all the previous school shooting cases of the last several years, with a great number of people from Columbine. And several people from that team have then worked with me for the last close to 9 years, including Duane Fuselier, who is a psychologist with the FBI, a clinical psychologist, and who led the Columbine investigation. And he'd done a lot of the psychological work for the FBI already on hostage negotiations and so forth. But I've talked to a whole team of different, worldwide forensic experts on this. And so I'm getting most of this from them. And I've, back and forth with them over the years. I talked to Duane, several times a month still. And so that's where I'm getting it all. As far as manic depressive, I just have not run across that. And Duane Fuselier has sort of, he spent his whole life as a hostage negotiator and training hostage negotiations and studying them for the FBI, and he's written a lot of the training manuals on them. And he has said these are the most common types that you see in those types of situations. So he's been dealing not just with school shooters, but with gunmen. He was actually at Waco. He was the last person to negotiate with the FBI before they went in. So he's been used to dealing with these kinds of shooters, and he sees the angry depressives more often than the manic depressives or bipolar. So that's not to say that it never comes up, but we're just talking about the most common categories here.
All right, and let's go on again to another caller here. This is someone in Champaign County here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, I haven't really immersed myself in this other than listening to the news, and I don't know what that is. I'm hearing a sound here.
Yeah, me too. I don't know what it is either.
Let's rise above it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm more preoccupied with pathology at global and national level, and I just on that point, we see a lot of blowback of returning vets coming in. Mm-hmm. We've had at least a couple of killings in rural. They're not mass killings, and they're usually very personal. But one thing, since you guys both probably have done the reading background, but on the other show that you did, there was no mention that he did this on Valentine's Day. And I just can't believe that in his mind, I don't know what to interpret from that, but the fact that I haven't heard anybody mention it at all, I really, he apparently had supposedly a good relationship with his girlfriend here who says she still loves him. And but it seems to me that male rage and frustration is tied up in I wonder whether you've read anything. Have you heard any? Is anybody making that kind of analysis? I haven't heard it, and it just seems that the fact that he did it on Valentine's Day is just can be dismissed. And I don't know how to interpret it, but I'm sort of just raising it and.
Yeah. Well, I apologize for here cutting in. I'm not really quite sure what our problem is there with the phone, but I think that the caller raises a good question. I think that obviously one is just engaging here in speculation, but you would have to think that selecting that particular day was not an accident. What significance it might have had to him, we don't No, but I think I'm with the caller in suggesting that wanting to believe that that has some meaning.
Yes, and I would agree. pardon me. I would think that it probably will. And I think there's a couple things about this case that I want to say, which is this case looks more like the common case because there were specific things we can see that he did, so we have some intent. Now, usually what happens with a school shooter, some kid goes in there, starts firing randomly into the crowd. Everyone assumes, oh, he just got angry, something just happened, he just snapped, and he just started shooting. That is almost never the case. The Secret Service study showed that almost all of them had prior intent and had been planning this for some time, at least a few days, frequently much longer. What we have in this case is somebody that looks like what really happened. When you can see, okay, he left U of I, he drove up to DeKalb, got a hotel room at the Travel Lodge. You know, he planned this out. He had something specific going on. He picked Valentine's Day. So we still don't know why he did any of those things, but what he looks like the other school shooters in the fact that he looks, I think we can be sure of one thing. He had a reason for doing all this. This was not arbitrary. We don't know what the reason is yet, and hopefully we'll get to the bottom of it, but as in most of the school shooters, he had a plan. He worked all this out. There was a reason he went to Cole Hall. There's probably a reason he picked Valentine's Day, and I think the caller is right. It probably had some romantic association. Hopefully we'll find that out. Now, we know that he wiped his hard drive clean, and he also took the SIM card out of his phone. Now, that strikes me as kind of unusual because often the perpetrator wants us to know. They typically go in the other direction, where they really desperately want us to know why he did it. And in the case of both Columbine and Virginia Tech, all three of the perpetrators left, you know, massive manifestos explaining themselves and wanted the world. You know, Dylan and Eric went to great lengths to, they weren't sure their video, their journals would be enough, so they made the basement tapes, the videotapes, to say, here's why we're doing it. So this is really kind of strange that you've got this guy who has really specific things he's doing and obvious intent, and also takes steps to cover them up. But hopefully we will recover his hard drive. You know, most people think if you wipe your hard drive that everything's off of it, but that's not true. Unless you've, you know, written over it with ones and zeros, usually most of it can be recovered. So we may well find, you know, all sorts of things on his hard drive. And we may still find out why he did this. But I think the one thing we can conclude that this was not arbitrary. He, for whatever reason he had one.
Well, you point to something here that I think is important, and people who have studied these individuals say the same thing, that we should not think that this was a spontaneous, spur-of-the-moment thing, that people, as you say, people don't just snap. They plan, and they do that in a very deliberate way, and it can take some period of time. And so that leaves us with this question. Should there have been individuals in these people's lives, could be their parents, could be their friends, could be their teachers, could be people around them, who should have recognized that something was going on, and then if they took their concerns to someone, to the parents, to the teachers, to school administrators, to somebody, could that in any way have prevented one of these things from taking place?
Yes, and I would say probably. And I hope I'm not overemphasizing this report. There's also another great FBI report, and I think you can get to both of these from my website, but also if you just Google them, you can find one. And I'll, or you can go to the Slate article on my website, cites both of these. But the FBI refers to this as leakage. Is the idea that people always leak. They nearly always leak. They nearly always tell somebody. And in the other study, they both had statistics on leakage, but I'm looking at the Secret Service one right in front of me right now. 81% of the cases, other people knew about the attack before it took place. I'm reading these words. In 81% of the cases, at least one person had information that the attacker was thinking about or planning the school attack. In nearly two-thirds of the incidents, more than one person had information about the attack. Then if you go further, that's people who actually knew that the killer was planning an attack, not just that there was something wrong in their life. In terms of people who realized there was a problem but didn't realize what it was, 93% of the cases, in 93% of the cases, the attackers engaged in some behavior prior to the attack that caused other school officials, parents, teachers, police, fellow students, etc., to be concerned. In most of the cases, at least one adult was concerned by the attacker's behavior. That's in 88%. And in three-quarters of the cases, three different people were concerned by the attacker's behavior. So, you know, this could be the exception, but probably not. It's likely, if history follows here, that it's going to turn out that several people in his life were really concerned and were afraid something was going to happen, and that probably some people even knew, at least one or perhaps more people knew, that an attack with guns on other human beings was being planned. That would be statistically what we can guess. This may or may not be the exception.
Yeah. Let's get at least one more caller here. We have someone calling from the community of Belgium, not all that far away. That's line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, the only observation I'd like to make on this is that the two gentlemen at Columbine were unique in the fact that there were two of them. Almost all the rest of these things are people who act on their own.
Mm-hmm.
I think that must be significant also.
It is. I would agree with that, except I think it's a bit of an overstatement. I need to get the exact figures, but somewhere between 80-90% of these kinds of attacks are individuals. In school shooters, it does tend to be individuals, but these other kinds of incidents, there's about 10-15% which are pairs. The FBI refers to them as dyads, and you've seen those through history. You've got Bonnie and Clyde, you got Frank and Jesse James. Leopold and Loeb. More recently, we had in the D.C. sniper case about 8 or 10 years ago, the two guys who, for about a week or two, terrorized the Capitol by shooting people. So there is, you're right, it is a very, very different situation where you've got the two, and you've got a different psychological dynamic going on where they're sort of both feeding off each other. And it is unusual. Some of the psychologists that I've worked with on this case really feel that a lot more research needs to be done because no one has really studied the whole dyad phenomenon and what's driving them.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Has there been a case of a story like this where we're talking about this kind of pattern, the school shooting, excluding anything that could be considered to be a case of terrorism, organized terrorism that has political or ideological underpinnings? Any case where the perpetrator was female? Do you know of any?
No. In the school shooting, I'm trying to think how many people I study here. In every one of the school shooting cases, and the Secret Service had some definition of, I can't remember exactly how they defined them, of they call it something else, like some kind of incident, but every single one of them was male. That was the only thing that everyone had in common, was that they were all male. Yeah, females hardly ever do this. In non-school shooting situations where you have a gunman, occasionally there'll be a female. Some of the members of the Manson family, for example, were female, although they were obviously led by Charles Manson, who was male. But you've had a few other females over time, but it's pretty rare. It's pretty much a male phenomenon, unfortunately.
Hmm. We're coming down to the point where we have to finish. This is obviously a story. This particular story is one that people will continue to write about and think about for a long time. Maybe there will be some answers to these questions. Maybe not. But I guess I am going back to this basic idea, and we talked about it at the beginning, that in as much as events like this may be difficult to understand, they're not impossible to understand, and that if you dig hard enough, if you talk to enough people, if you look at the background of the individuals retrospectively, you can come up with an explanation. And in many cases, it does become clear. So you don't have to get to that point where you say, well, things happen and I don't know why. And this is an example of how that happens in the world.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. And I think there's one other frustration for listeners out there, is that sometimes it takes a while, And unfortunately, the media interest in the story is, you know, typically a week or two, and then they move on. And often we don't find out the truth or the full truth until much later. And I think that's what happened with Columbine. A lot of what seemed like a lot of information was coming out initially, but most of it wasn't. You know, the journals were held by the police. The police didn't even announce for, I believe, 6 months that the basement tapes even existed. So it was years before all this information really came to light and we knew what was going on. Although the police investigation knew within a couple months. But even there, it took a couple months. And here in this case, it may be a few months, it may be longer before that we know the truth. And a lot of the people who are interested by then will have moved on. And so they will keep getting the impression from one of these after another, well, they never come up with an answer. And I guess my advice would be, come back in a couple of months, search the web, and look around then, because there probably will be an answer.
There, we'll have to stop for right now. Our guest, Dave Cullen, is a journalist and author. His writing has appeared in Slate, Salon, The New York Times, and he's the author of a forthcoming book scheduled to be published in March of 2009 about Columbine. Again, the title, A Lasting Impression on the World, The Definitive Account of Columbine and Its Aftermath. And, Mr. Cullen, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, David. It was great.
Okay.